Oh, hey, before we start the show, let me just mention that Mythic Bastionland is written by Chris McDowell with amazing art by Alex Sorensen, and you can find more information about the game at bastionland.com. The Smiling Fox, on the other side, is very much an unofficial fan project, a podcast by fans for fans. And in any case, you shouldn't trust the Smiling Fox. He's kind of a dodgy fella.
Welcome to the Smiling Fox. My name is Horst.
I am Brian.
And I'm William.
And today's episode is called The Art of War, where we will be talking about combat.
Okay, I think a good way to open is to compare combat in Mythic Bastionland to other games. What makes it unique and what's special about Mythic Bastionland combat?
There is an interesting blog post by Chris McDowell called Decisive Combat, I think, where he talks about that in more traditional games, there is longer time spent on should we fight, the combat options, and then the aftermath of the fight. Whereas in Into the Odd, for example, the steps from one phase to the next are much quicker.
The rule I hear people talking about most when comparing Mythic Bastionland with Into the Odd is ganging up. In Mythic Bastionland, multiple attackers roll together on when they're attacking the same opponent, and you take the highest die. And in Into the Odd, you can gang up and all roll damage on one person. What impact do you think that has on play?
I think that fights in Into the Odd are even quicker if number plays a role. If you fight a group of people, a large group, or if you on your side have like four or five player characters and you're attacking a single target, combat will be even more decisive.
The times when playing Mythic Bastionland, when a group gangs up on an enemy, it's over pretty quick as well. Just because you're getting one or two impairs, if the first one fails, you can try again. After applying a few bolsters, the likelihood of then dropping down to half vigor increases quite dramatically. Even though you're not applying damage like directly in the same way, I do find that the ganging up in Mythic Bastionland is pretty brutal.
So Electric Bastionland would be right in the middle, where you only roll the highest die, but you don't have any kind of special moves.
I've seen on the Discord a lot of people who are talking about introducing the Gambits to Electric Bastionland with great success.
I'm skeptical because the idea is completely different. Like the idea of a failed career, of somebody who is in debt, who is like a lower class citizen who fights tooth and nails to pay back the debt, is different from the hyper competent knight that is protecting the realm.
I feel that gambits can be a good fit anywhere. Especially, I mean, they're applied also for the enemies you're fighting against. And you can flavor them with fighting dirty and taking advantage of the situation. It doesn't necessarily need to be competent martial arts.
Yeah, that is a good point. Like you make the fights more tactical. I don't want the scruffy underdogs to have an arsenal of cool moves, and the fight to be particularly strategic. I'm happy for it being over quickly.
I think that touches on an interesting idea of how the rules inform the world and the characters that you're playing. So, like in Mythic Bastionland, we have feats and gambits, and the players are knights. The combat in this, to me, seems like it is informing how you roleplay to some extent.
I try and run my games as if you're reading a like an author in legend. So you make it somewhat dreamlike and then having the battles slightly out of reality. I've had a few people at my table who struggle to narrate how they bolster someone else's attack. If you're looking at it from like a narrative, you can say, well, we're all lunging towards this individual, and thus, they're put on their back foot and the attack deals more damage. It's like a romantic knightly story often. And in that sense, I find that the mechanics work pretty well for that.
I've seen it a few times in the Discord when people, referees are talking about how to narrate combat. They want to do it in a very zoomed in way, as if everything is an individual move that you talk about. But I think it does make more sense to roll the dice, have a little bit of discussion among the players of, you know, how does this look? And it's a little bit more abstracted, I think, than what people might be used to in some other systems.
All the dice play a role, unless it's it's lower than a four. I do think it allows players to all contribute to the narration. I don't know if people play with battle maps. Most people will play a theater of the mind. And then you can use the dice to have a pretty comprehensive narration of the fight.
For me, the stereotypical bad RPG battle is someone is sitting at the table for a long time waiting to do something, and then it's their opportunity to do something and they roll a dice and nothing happens. Is that possible in Mythic Bastionland?
I guess it is. If you do roll nothing but threes, it might feel as if you're not contributing to the fight.
In its defense, you're probably waiting for less time. You know, you're not like, okay, I have this ability and that stacks with this ability, and because we're fighting against this type of enemy, I can add this bonus. It's pretty straightforward. You have your weapons and you have a knightly ability and you have tactical choice, but everyone mostly has the same tactical choices, so you're speaking the same language, which I think speeds things up probably. Okay, I want to do a mini You Be the Judge segment. So you're running a combat and there's a player at the table who has just rolled threes and they look extremely bored. Do you do anything?
Especially if they look bored, I would still ask them to describe how maybe their blow glanced off the armor or was deflected. I mean, they're still fighting.
The times that I've had people roll badly, maybe the first time I'll describe that their weapon is blocked. And then the second time they do something similar where they describe how they slip on the mud or something like that. And at least the players that I've had up until now have been able to do that quite seamlessly, where rolling bad doesn't matter because you're enjoying the show, essentially.
If you want to be real generous, you could kind of nudge them towards what do you do to get a tactical advantage so that on their next attack, they could get a bonus die.
I get questions about flanking pretty often. So my house rule now is that if you have three of you are ganging up against one enemy, I'll give a D8 as kind of like a pseudo flanking die, I guess. And in that situation, you just give it to the person who's had the worst rolls up until that point. And I think something like that might be decent to combat, you know, someone having really bad luck.
That seems very reasonable. Like in that situation, three people surrounding someone, that there would definitely be a tactical advantage, yeah.
To me, that sounds, again, a bit board gamey. I think that the best combat has some kind of context, has some kind of terrain features, or some kind of interesting environment.
Definitely adding in some stuff around you, or something that has a potential to do harm. Like the classic thing is you're fighting on the edge of a cliff or beside a fire or something, you know, that people can get a bit tossed into a dangerous environment because of that.
There's an interesting blog post by Patrick Stewart, who wrote Deep Carbon Observatory, for example, and it's called, I think, Stored Kinetic Energy. So introducing something to the battlefield, like a taut rope, for example, like the classic pirate thing, you cut it through and then you're whipped up. Something that can drop down, something that can collapse, a spring that is about to be released, that kind of thing.
It's interesting that when we think of these examples, we're going to like a man-made environment. And I feel like the default in Mythic Bastionland is probably you're going to be fighting in an open plain or in a forest or something. And maybe you need to come at it from a different angle to think of what interesting things could there be there. Maybe there's like an animal that's, if it's provoked, it could join the fight or something.
elevations, obviously. I don't know, thorny bush barriers, I guess. You mentioned a ravine that you could push enemies into.
The first thing that came into my mind is you have a wasp's nest in the tree that someone can shoot an arrow at or something.
Breath of the Wild style. You can always have a boulder on a hill, obviously.
A lot of my battles happen in like foresty or like wooded areas. It's okay to have like some forest critters and tell the players that there's trees around.
If a player says, you know, are there rocks on the ground that I can throw at this guy? What's your default? Are you saying yes? Or are you doing a look roll? Or
in my games, it's if it makes sense, then yes. If it's there's a likelihood, then we're going to roll d6 for it. And if it doesn't really make sense, usually I'm like, they probably wouldn't be here, but you might find this or this.
Yeah, I think it depends on the question, obviously. But if people are thinking of that to ask, there's probably a reasonable expectation that that's something you would find. Unless they're really just trying to take advantage in some way. Okay, let's dig into some kind of nitty-gritty details of combat. Another difference between Mythic Bastion Land and other Into the Odd and related games is what happens when you're mortally wounded. Into the Odd, you roll a save. Mythic Bastion Land, if you've lost half of your remaining vigor, you're mortally wounded. For me, I think that's something that has a big effect on pacing. It cuts out a roll that might slow things down a little bit. What do you guys think of that?
I have mixed feelings. You're completely right. It speeds up everything. But I do miss the chance to get back into the fight. I do see the reasoning. And I like everything that speeds up combat. But I find myself wondering every time that happens, now there will be a save. And then I remember, this is not Into the Odd.
William, do you have any thoughts on it?
I used to play D&D and you have your undead creatures, and when they should die, you get to roll a constitution save to determine whether they actually die or not. And I always forgot that. And I fear that if I start playing Into the Odd now, I'm going to forget to roll the saves, and I'm just going to have them receive mortal wounds at half of their remaining vig.
I always found in D&D the idea of you are dying and you have this weird little mini game where you're rolling to see if you fail three times and then you die, or if you succeed three times, then you come back. I find that quite bizarre, and I always find it hard to remember the actual details of how it works. Yeah, it's quite stark in Mythic Bastion Land that with this amount of vigor loss, you're down and out of the fight, and you've got no control over that. But it makes sense, you know? To me, it fits the tone and style of the game very well.
Yeah, to reference the blog post again, Decisive Combat, it just speeds up things. One PC is now down and dying, and that poses a problem to the remaining players. They have to deal with it.
That's mortal wounds. The other kind of significant aspect of taking damage is scars. Any thoughts on the scar system?
For the longest time, I was under the impression that a scar means permanent effects. So you can, in theory, improve your stats, or you could, in theory, lose stats point. That is not the case. No. So stat loss is temporary, but gaining points and stats is permanent. And the way it is described in the rules, or maybe explained to me on the Discord, is that they learn to deal with whatever the scar is. And I think the whole scar system is a way to explain how you learn from a terrible thing happen. And that's why you get better, or at least you won't get worse.
I think the stat loss that is connected to the scar should be at least somewhat permanent. It's the next time they gain glory that they return their spirit, or the next time they do something else, they get their clarity back. Instead of having the normal way to replenish those stats, to have a little bit of like some kind of quest, narrative quest connected to it. Because then it's like in that moment, you're still suffering from your agony. You've cheated death and it haunts you. I don't think that should go away like super easy.
So for example, one of the scars is stun, pain drowns the senses, lose D6 clarity. I do like the idea that, you know, you lose that clarity and to regain it, you know, you might need to talk to an old sword master who trained you and they give you some advice that helps you regain your confidence or something. I think that's narratively quite interesting, but there's always a balance with, are you punishing a player with stat loss who doesn't want to lose their character? And they might lose their character if you're playing around with, let's make all these numbers lower for dramatic effect.
I don't think it's super punishing, but it just adds one little extra, I guess, like side quest that you can then, you weigh in with whatever you're doing in the session. Do I want to, you know, incorporate this side quest, or am I okay with having two less than what my maximum is? So you get like that kind of balance, I think. And it's also cool. You like, you have some disfigurement and you go to the rotten seer and he places some rotten mulch and mushrooms in that area and it heals over in that sense. And, you know, you stink wherever you go now because you've got this rotten odor.
Yeah, definitely. The idea of characters getting weirder rather than better is very OSR. I do think, so we mentioned earlier the idea of, you know, losing a limb or like things that logically you might say, oh, this person would have lower vigor. Again, coming back to the knights, I think when you think of it as being a tale of valorous knights, it makes sense. You know, there's this character who, despite various conditions or whatever, he was so honorable and so great that he overcame everything and was the most powerful.
Yeah, I would agree. It's almost like in kung fu movies, the blind master, the fact that they're blind obviously doesn't really hold them back.
I think you can lose an eye with a particular scar. So, I mean, if you get unlucky and it happens twice, you have a blind knight. Speaking of horrible things happening to knights, are there cases where you have used the exposed rule, or are examples that you think are worth discussing?
I had an adventure in a burial mound that was infested by spiders, which, by the way, is an idea from Chris McDowell's blog, I don't know, 4 years ago. Obviously, I had to steal it. So the burial mound was infested by wolf spiders, whatever that is. And the player character entered one of the rooms within the burial mound, and there was all, you know, the spider webs on the ground. I telegraphed the kind of trap very obviously. They stepped into the webbing on the floor and they got stuck. And so when the spider attacked, I ruled that they were exposed. In general, obviously in Into the Odd and in Mythic Bastionland, one of the advices always be obvious with these trap things because it can feel unfair.
In my solo game, I had a character attacked while they were asleep and almost killed. But I'm meaner to myself than I am.
I think that was one of the birds, right?
Yeah, there's a danger to, I'm in a bad mood, so I'm going to sleep away from the camp in the wilderness. So I think that's a risk that you could telegraph. Are you sure you want to leave the campfire? You know, there's dangers out there. Okay, among the gambits, there is one that perhaps stands out, which is impair. Impair a weapon on their next turn. So that would mean that you roll 4 or higher, you select the weapon of an opponent, and the weapon will be impaired, which means they'll roll a d4 rather than whatever damage dice are associated with that weapon.
Why do you think impair is overpowered? It doesn't seem to be the impair itself, but more the spamming of it.
Yeah, I was just thinking, if it's a 1v1, if you're having a duel, for example, and someone's impairing, I mean, it comes down to probability. You're spending a gambit to do that. It's not always going to work. But if you have a team of knights fighting against one opponent, yeah, someone's probably going to be able to impair, you know, if everyone's trying to impair. So I think that's probably the scenario that people are concerned about.
I find that it is, of the gamut, if all else is the same, probably the most powerful. obviously there are certain situations where stopping someone from moving or whatever. But I also, like, intuitively it made sense to me that some weapons shouldn't be able to, like, especially natural weapons, shouldn't be able to impair that easily. We should probably also mention Chris's blog post of impairing, that states that outright, that that's like a harsh rule you can implement, where most natural weapons can't just be impaired because it's this, you know, magnificent creature.
I was a player once in a game where we attacked like a lizard, and I had a halberd, I think, and I wedged it into the jaw of the lizard, mm-hmm. and I thought, well, it can still attack, but its attack is impaired. So I think narratively it made sense.
Did you lose your weapon? Did you let go of your weapon to put it in that position?
I had to hold the weapon in position. Mm. I couldn't use it for an attack in the next round.
You're agreeing with me more than maybe you let on, because you're sacrificing more than your 4+ die roll, because you're now saying, this is what I'm doing with my action, moving on to block this attack. And to me, that's like, it fits the narrative, that makes sense. Go on, we can roll for this and see if it works or not.
Yeah, the question I think it comes down to is the narration just window dressing? So the dice determine everything, or is it, do you have to describe how you want to actually use that die to make it a thing? And I think that most people would probably agree that it is a bit board gamey in the sense that, okay, we roll the dice, they have that effect, and then we just explain after the fact how that looks like. But I do think that as a referee, you have a little bit of room to demand that it makes sense in the fiction.
What I'd be inclined to do is lean more into rulings rather than putting so much weight on this individual rule and look at the narrative and look at what's happening. Let's say you've got three knights fighting against some master martial artist type guy who has some weapon, and they keep impairing the weapon. A smart fighter will learn that that's what they're doing and do something differently. And within the fiction, essentially say to them, that won't work again. You know, he's learned that trick. He's found a way around it. I think that's fair to the players. You know, you got the benefit of using that tactic, and you got a few hits in, and now he has, like, adapted, and he's taking a different approach, and, you know, you won't trap him as easily next time. So what else are you going to do?
If you want to kind of gamify it, you could demand that the next impair would be a strong gambit that can be saved.
Yeah.
Because it does feel very punishing to say, well, you can't do the one trick that you really like.
On the broader concept of how you want the combat to go, when we think about, like, giving examples earlier of what, like, a bad combat looks like, you don't want it just to be reducing numbers until something's zero and then it's over. So the combat should shift and change and be dynamic. And I think any tactic that is repetitive and it feels like, another approach is, you know, the knights have repeatedly impaired someone, and the guy just says, okay, I surrender. You know, you've beaten me because I'm unable to strike. That's a reasonable outcome. You know, they've outwitted him and he doesn't know what to do. I think some players would feel fairly satisfied that they defeated their morale, essentially. I think the whole thing just comes down to being creative. That single sentence for here's something that's possible in battle is the starting point for discussions on, okay, you can do that, but there's this risk, or, yeah, you've done that, but it worked last time, it doesn't work this time, or, you know, I think you can play with it. Okay, so impairing is obviously a standout gambit, but the gambit list is not exhaustive. It does say these are example gambits, and other things of similar effect could be done. Have you experienced people being creative with other gambits?
Maybe as a referee, you should mention that more. Maybe you should create, or I should create, a more dynamic battle environment where either they have to come up with a gambit because the existing ones are not sufficient, or there is one that is obvious or implied or encouraged by what is going on in the game.
I think with any role-playing game, there is a possibility that people look at the your character sheet as buttons that you can push, and it's like, I'm playing a video game and this is everything I can do. When we were talking to Thomas in the last episode, he referred to gambits as stunts. And I think that is a word that possibly encourages people to think outside the box a little bit more. If someone says, do a stunt, you imagine some kind of acrobatics or whatever, where gambit is maybe a little bit, people might be inclined to look at the list more so than get creative with it. I can't think of a particular example. I'm sure there have been in games that I've played where people have used the gambits to do something unusual. I would probably imagine it to be interacting with the environment in some significant way, like opening up some opportunity to throw somebody out a window or whatever the situation is.
Grappling is a classic example of things that are annoying to adjudicate in other games. In Mythic Bastionland, it could just be maybe a strong gambit. I don't know.
If someone said to me they want to grapple as a gambit, I'd be fine with that.
If you want to grapple someone, that's essentially the stop gambit. And then if you want to do something extra, then it does make sense to make it a stronger gambit.
You could treat it as those two characters are now so closely wrapped together that basically they can struggle and fight each other, but anyone else who wants to attack is unable to, or there's a risk that they might harm their ally. I think it opens up some interesting possibilities. One thing that I often forget is that gambits come with saves. The strong, you can't save against the strong gambit, but for a standard gambit, you can. I really like that. There's a real tension there of, you know, someone rolls, they probably want to do significant damage. It hasn't worked out, but then they're like, okay, I can still do something. And then they get creative and they think about what they want to do. But then the other character, you know, you're not beaten yet. You have a chance to win against this. That's so dynamic.
I also like the fact that you have to use a die 8 or higher that you would love to use for damage for the strong gambit, just in order to make sure that the opponent won't be able to save.
The other thing, I actually need to consult the rules on this, but the focus feat, create an opening to exploit, use after rolling an attack, perform a gambit without using a die. It's the feat that I see used the least. I think it's quite an interesting feat. It's not a strong gambit, but I quite like that one. And I guess depending on the knight you roll, that might be something you lean into if you have like a high clarity.
Let's assume you have low vigor and high clarity, then you could see a knight relying on focus more.
Okay, so here's a question for you guys. A knight attacks three different enemies before rolling, decides to make a blast attack so it can attack each one of them. Can they focus on each one of those attacks, or does it count as one attack and they can only focus on one enemy? First, you start off using the smite feat to blast. You then attack each of the three enemies. Can you use the focus feat to add a gambit to each of those attacks, or only to one of them?
But, William, you can only use one feat once at an attack. Future Horse from the editing room here. Just a clarification. You can use any given feat only once per attack, assuming that you passed your save. So you can smite, pass your save, focus, pass your save, and then you can even deny. What you can't do is use a feat twice per attack. All right, back to the show.
I don't think I would allow that. But if I was playing with one player, which is probably quite a difficult, you know, like one knight up against various things could be quite risky. Maybe.
I have another question. Something that came up, I think, on Reddit. If you are leading a warband and you want your gambits to have an effect, do you also have to blast? Or is it that being part of the warband and leading it already gives you kind of the scale of the warband?
Everything's moved up one notch on the scale. So if you want to impair the other warband, prevent their attacks from being as effective, that, you know, you issue the order, block their spears or something.
It's not that you have to blast to have an extra effect. It's you are the leader of the warband and you're causing the warband to impair, and they have the blast scale, like they have the blast effect anyways.
Yeah, and I think everything we talk about, you see the kind of elegance in the rules that there's a cost to everything. So like leading a warband is powerful, but then there's the risk that you're exposed to the... Remind me how that goes?
Yeah, another question, because and when you're leading the warband, you're getting the damage that the warband gets. But the warband doesn't get blast damage, right? Like if a warband attacks a warband, it's just die against die. So let's say you fight mercenary warband. They have a D8, their spear, and the D4, their shield. So you just face the D4 and the D8.
I guess what it does, you join the warband and then you move up that scale to operate at a higher level. But yeah, I feel like a knight leading a warband should be able to do impressive things, and that warband should be a special warband. You know, the warband that's led by, you know, Lady whoever is going to be more effective on the battlefield than some mercenaries that are running around.
And can you deny as a leading a warband?
My instinct is you can do everything. But I'm happy to hear other ideas. I think it's an interesting question.
I don't know. You'd have to explain it in a way that makes sense. I find that sometimes quite difficult to do.
It's not that the lady so-and-so swaps the arrows out of the air on her own. She says to the warband, raise your shields! And then they deny the attack. Yeah. She's leading the warband. She's not as an individual doing crazy stunts.
Yeah, that probably makes more sense. If it's more of the commander role is what's actually the deny feat. I think, that makes a surprising amount of sense, actually.
When do you guys give situational bonus dice? Do you have any reservations about doing that, or are you generous with them?
I personally am generous. I want to reward like creative thinking that is actually creative. It's not I'm standing on a stone. No, I obviously have an elevated position and I want my D6. I had the knights attacking a bandit's cave and they positioned themselves above the entrance to the cave and dropped down. That seems to me worthy of an extra D8.
The game that which Thomas played in that was run by Judd that we discussed in the last episode, there was a conversation before a battle where Thomas's character had kind of insulted a knight's honor or said, you know, you shouldn't be fighting this battle, you should give up this claim that you're making. And Judd awarded a bonus die for the first attack because those words were so cutting. And I liked that. Let's start with William. How do you feel about that? Do you feel like insults or taunts should be rewarded in that way?
I vaguely remember that moment happening, and I thought it was pretty nifty because it wasn't something I had thought of, but it did kind of make sense to me. I could probably be more free-giving with the extra DAs because I don't really hand them out that often. If you insult someone or you say something to put them slightly off kilter, that does make a lot of sense. And if you're doing it in a way of, you know, you're role-playing in a way that's interesting for the rest of the table, I don't mind being a little bit more giving than I would be otherwise. So I think that does make sense.
It comes up in the context of stat loss, where somebody would taunt or insult someone and that would incur then a, I don't know, like a spirit save or a clarity save or something. I am not a big fan. Neither am I a fan of the bonus die for like verbal attacks in that way. I can't remember that scene, to be honest. I can imagine that if it's like you're exposing their most kept secret or their biggest shame ever.
Especially in battle, if you somehow shake someone and they lose their focus. I mean, you could treat that as they're impaired, maybe.
I'm pretty sure the Salt Knight essentially has an ability that has that written down where you insult someone. So Inspire Ire is like you make them hate you.
Any enemies that attack targets other than you lose D10 spirit. Wow. That's really cool.
I had this in one of my one-shots where they were trying to draw the enemy away from another target, but that knight was dealing a lot of damage. So the entity saw the knight that was hurting them as the biggest threat, and I kept making them roll to see which one it would focus on. And the Salt Knight was coming up with like really hilarious, but like really biting insults.
Yeah, I have a Salt Knight in my group. The result is that everybody hates the Salt Knight.
I'm wondering, is there a way to turn that around? So I'm wondering, is there an opposite to that? Like maybe the idea of leading a warband is an interesting one. So if you somehow inspire the warband, if a player gets really caught up in the role playing and gives a speech to, you know, we must win the day kind of thing. Bonus die? What do you think?
That is an interesting point. Again, referencing our Playbook Post warband against warband situation. There was a cool moment where Brian, playing Lady Anazinda, told the defenders to sing like a war song. And, you know, narratively I described that there was an effect. I didn't think it would be a mechanical effect. So I'm happy to just describe the reaction of the opponent being either impressed or your warband to be, you know, shouting and raising their weapons. And that is a cool scene in itself. Does it have to always be, you also get a plus D4 or something?
This is slightly off topic, but in the last session I played, there were knights investigating a murder and they were interrogating someone. And it was a long scene. They were kind of like good cop, bad cop sort of thing, and kind of coming at the character in different ways and trying different ways to get information or maybe a confession. And it really struck me as an interesting example of playing for a long time and not leaning too heavily on the rules. You can lean into the fiction, or there is an impact here, but it doesn't have to be, and the impact is this number.
Again and again, we come back to the action procedure that should clarify if there is a need for a roll. I'm completely happy with a whole session with zero rolls on the side of the...
Yeah.
Like no saves. There are obviously the wilderness rolls. There are rolls to see how the environment looks like. And these are not boring sessions. These are tense and interesting sessions. It's just not... There is a reason to roll because... you go through the list and they either have the leverage.
Yeah, and you can see in the players when they're eager for things to go their way and they're trying to muster that leverage. They're trying to think of every possible thing they can think of to make this go their way. It's tactical play, even though it's not, there's no rolling involved. Okay, so let's talk about exciting fights that we've run or things that have jumped out at you from fights. What was a special fight that you've had in your experience?
The first one that springs to mind is one of the first sessions I ran. We had the fight with the Wyvern, and the Wyvern myth has a squire that my party of two knights, so the odds were kind of against them to start off, but they enlisted the squire, and there was a moment where the squire made an oath to one of the knights. And they were at a dwelling, and they got all the able-bodied men with improvised weapons. So this was like their makeshift warband. And when it got to the fights, what made it pretty cool was how they used the warband because they were extremely inexperienced in battle. They actually kept their distance. They used the few bows they had, and they picked up stones and whatever. And they were busy attacking the wings of the creature as to not allow it to move around or to fly away. the way that they described flanking the creature so that if it faces one of them, the other one will be able to, you know, get to the soft underbelly of the creature. And in that way, it wasn't so much using the mechanics as such, but the way that they were just describing that whole battle. Also, leading up to the battle, they had gotten some sheep from the dwelling, which they chained to the ground as kind of like a way to lure the creature down. The creature flew above them and the sheep were obviously scared witless, and they started bleating, which caused the wyvern to focus on them. And the way that like narratively built up, and they had prepared the scene to their advantage, that was really gratifying.
You said that your improvised warband targeted the wings. Was that a gambit? Was that then stop gambit? Or was it more like, you know, you describe it in a cool way, I let it happen?
The warband was rolling really high, so I allowed it to be a stop gambit, although the wyvern was allowed to move around, it just wasn't allowed to fly. So it's kind of like half of the stop gambit. By the end of the battle, the creature had these large, tattered wings from being hit the whole time. There was, I don't know, an extra element that they added to it, which was pretty cool.
I do think that memorable combats can often be ones where there's a lot of planning involved. It's like, how are we going to approach this? And setting up some kind of trap or something. Horst, do you have one that comes to mind?
My most recent fight was probably my favorite one. And that was a duel between the Salt Knight and his arch enemy, the Iron Knight. The whole thing started like 20 sessions ago when he found out some troubling information about the Iron Knight. And finally, there was the trial of the Iron Knight. She was put on trial for betraying her oath. And because of some diplomatic shenanigans, the king was reluctant to punish her. So the Sword Knight said, let it be decided by trial by combat. And so they met at the Stonehenge, you know, before dawn. Everything's dark. The guards have the circle of torches. The Iron Knight had demanded that they fight without armor. And if you know the Iron Knight has the ability to just chop off a limb. There was a real sense of this could be the end of one of the protagonists of our story. And the way the fight went, you know, the way they talked to each other, there was, I want to say, an erotic tension between the Iron Knight and the Salt Knight. There was a feeling of finally getting revenge for the Salt Knight. They both pierced each other with the last move, which, again, kind of innuendo here. And then the Iron Knight said, I hoped we had more time together. And she was bleeding out. And now that it was trial by combat, there had to be one lives, one dies. So he had to finish her. And then the steward placed his hand on the wound of the dying Iron Knight, then made a bloody handprint on the stone. And she said, her body will be burned, but her blood is not wasted because it will strengthen the land. And then you could see that there were a lot of like fading bloody handprints on the stone.
Brian, do you have a good example?
Going way back, so I'm playing in a long campaign, but it began as a one-shot, as they sometimes do. And I decided that we're playing three sessions. We kind of agreed we'll play three sessions and see how this game plays. I thought, okay, a nice way to end this would be with a battle. And there's one from one of the myths that came up where there was a holding was basically being attacked by a warband. And the knights knew that this was going to happen. They talked to a seer, so they were riding as fast as they could to get to this location. And they come up on this hill and they look down. And this is towards the end of our final session. And there was this very threatening looking warband attacking or trying to get into a holding, and it was being defended by a kind of feeble group of people who had improvised, you know, some rough defense. So it looked really one-sided. And I wonder now if we had thought, okay, this is going to be a long campaign, would they have charged in and said, let's just fight? but it felt like the knights, you know, doing the honorable thing and trying to come to the aid of these the underdogs. They rode down, they got involved. I don't think we used leading from the front. I don't remember that. Mm. So it was, there was like warband combat happening, but also individual combat happening. The enemy warband had a leader that they, you know, they were fighting with him. And there was one PC death where he used his deny to protect an ally and kind of save the ally. But I think he became fatigued. So then when he needed it again, he couldn't muster it. So he kind of sort of sacrificed himself to defend someone else. And it was really dynamic. It was very exciting. When the character died, I just said to that player, okay, here's the stats of the, you know, defending warband. Just they're your stats for your new PC who's just one of those guys. And he kind of got straight back into it. So there was no, you know, there was no feeling of, okay, someone's going to sit on the sidelines. But yeah, that was very memorable. And it sort of, I don't know, potentially led us to saying, let's keep playing, you know, and we're still playing. So, and that was a good combat. For our final segment on this episode, we have You Be the Judge, where we will describe a situation that has come up in one of our games and each give our views on how we would handle it. Horst, what would you like to describe to us?
So we have been playing a play-by-post simulating a strange situation where William is leading two warbands, a battle ram operated by militia, to seize a tower that is defended by Brian's character and a warband. And the situation is that one of the warband's mercenaries have siege ladders and they are climbing this tower. Half of the warband is on the ladder. The other half of the warband is still on the ground. The defenders are up on the tower. William suggested that the half of the warband that is on the ground pick up stones and throw it at the defenders. My question is, how would you adjudicate this?
And this is an unusual You Be the Judge, because I was a player here. So what I had on the top of the tower was a warband that had up until this point been acting as archers. But I said just before the ladders came up that they ready their axes or whatever. So they're kind of prepared for people to start coming up. I think something that's obvious is that the guys who are coming up on the ladders are at a disadvantage. So you need to account for that in some way. And I think it makes sense to me. Well, okay. This is tricky because, okay, I'll talk through my thinking. So they're at a disadvantage, but also they're divided. Like there is an argument to say it's now a warband fighting against an individual because there's one guy at the top of, well, there's two ladders. But, you know, there's two guys at the top of these ladders. So do you begin, do you have one round of combat where it's a warband fighting two guys? And if those guys somehow manage to hold on, then that, you know, overflows into success at the whole operation of getting up the ladders. You've also got the guys down on the ground throwing the stones. All I'm doing is thinking out loud. I clearly don't have a solution. Yeah, it's complicated. I love the situation, by the way. But go ahead, William.
I think what makes the most sense to me is the people who are coming up are impaired. My idea was that the stones on the ground, those on the ground who are throwing stones up are just going to maybe distract one or two fighters. That'll create a bit of an opening for those climbing up. I'll make it a little bit more difficult to, you know, get the first blow in. That'll allow the warband to at least mount onto the top of the tower.
But it's still, they're still behaving as a warband rather than as individuals.
You don't make the attack when the first one arrives or when the first two arrive. You make the attack after the movement. So just keeping in the system in that way, I think it does make the most sense to keep them as a warband. So I would impair them. I'm not entirely sure if I would give the attackers any kind of advantage for that. Maybe I'd give them a bonus. I'm not entirely sure, because it makes more sense if they just like are able to knock the ladders down or something like that. But the fact that we have to stay within the bounds of this, what makes sense in game form, it makes sense that the warband is moving up, the attackers are moving up, and they are pushing back somehow. It's just they're not going to be super effective at that. And I think if you impair the incoming warband, you're essentially making them, you know, deal zero damage. There's like a 25% chance that they'll deal damage. So I feel that is already punishment enough that it kind of balances it out.
I'm kind of mulling around in my head ways to make it more complex. I think making them impaired, I think I would lean towards a bonus for the other force as well. You could, just using what's given by Mythic Bastionland, do some kind of luck roll on how long does it take to get the whole warband up the ladders. You know, and if it goes poorly, you're going to be impaired on the next round as well, because there's, you know, some of the guys have gotten up, but not all of them. But if they somehow scurry up very fast, then you're not impaired anymore. Let's go to the master of this scenario, Horst. What's the true answer?
Obviously, there's no true answer. I definitely like the idea of the attackers climbing up the ladder being impaired. I judged that the rolling the stones will occupy half of the warband that is on the ground, which makes climbing up the ladder like a longer pursuit. It will take two rounds instead of one round. If they just focus on the climbing, they won't throw their stones, but they get up the ladder more quickly. If they want to focus on throwing the stones, they will get a D4, which is a pretty, you know, low bonus die. I also ruled that the defenders, because of their superior position, get a D8. And that was my ruling. After the fact, I'm not sure. Like, I think I should go with Willem's suggestion of having the attackers be impaired for the first round.
Yeah.
And I should probably have given the defenders a higher die, maybe a D10. But after the fact, you're always smarter.
I mean, listen, what you feel when you're playing in that scene, I think, is more, as the defender, you're like, oh, crap, I'm in trouble now. You know, I'm not thinking about, oh, he just gave me a D8. I really wish he gave me a D10. I do have a kind of a follow-up question, because I know the scenario, which is, once they were up on top, and at some point, I tried to use a gambit to repel them, and I said, I want to push them back towards the ladders, which failed, because William passed the save. But I'm curious what could have happened. You know, if you repel this attacking force, you're on this confined tower, and you're pushing them back, I mean, do they start descending the ladders, or do they topple over, some of them fall over the edge, or do they, you're trapping them close to where they came up? Any thoughts on that?
Mm. What makes sense to me is you're not going to push the whole warband off the edge of the tower and have them fall to their death. The few at the back that do get pushed over, probably the best way to represent that is with something like decreasing vigor.
Yeah, I mean, you could say, okay, so there's guys at the back of the warband who can't actually attack because they're up against the edge, and they don't have an opening to attack. Mm. So that sounds like, you know, a disadvantage there.
I'm happy that you failed the roll, because I didn't have to think about it.
I can see that this situation in a crunchier system would have something tracking progress in some way, you know?
Yeah.
Like something tracking whether the battle is going in favor of someone. I totally think the Mythic Bastionland can handle this and handles it well. Mm. And the important thing is that it's dynamic, and even play by post, it feels dynamic. You can see the shift in, because when I was just acting as a band of archers, I was just kind of steadily decreasing the vigor of these guys who were attacking until they got to the point that they were able to kind of come into hand-to-hand combat. And I found it quite dramatic to have that shift happen.
Well, listeners, dramatic combat is what Mythic Bastionland is known for and what you will experience if you're having fight scenes in Mythic Bastionlands. Thank you for listening for another episode, and I hope to see you all soon. Bye.
Cheers.
Bye.